You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her door.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of water. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar. And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn, you bet. My country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious. Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the one country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Weird weather, huh? It's a lot of people talking about how much they love this heat wave, but makes me a little nervous. Makes me a little nervous for lots of reasons. It confuses the birds, for one thing. For the last 2 days, my mockingbirds are back, and they are just singing like nobody's business. And I thought, oh, you know, I hope they're going to be okay if it gets really cold again in a couple weeks. Anyway, I could talk about the weather for the entire hour. If you've been listening to this show for very long, you know that, you know, we go for a week in January, February without rain, and I start panicking. Oh no, it's a drought year. So I'll try not to panic yet, because we have a really good guest. We have Nick Goldschmidt with us. We are going to be talking about the wines of Argento and probably some other things as well. And I really appreciate you came down on a Sunday night. You're not doing what a lot of people are doing today, watching television.
And I'm happy about that.
Good. Me too. Me too. So you do a lot of work in South America.
Yeah, I've been working in... I first started going to Chile back in 1989, and subsequently after that into Argentina. I was the chief still winemaker for Louis Vuitton, and we created a brand down there called Terrazas in Argentina, and so I went down and headed that up. This is while I was still the winemaker at Simi Winery. I was a winemaker at Simi Winery for 14 years, and subsequent to that I went off and ran Allied Domecq, which was a large conglomerate company, in 2003, and that put me into 8 countries. But today I have my own brands, and then I consult in seven other countries, including about 18 individual wineries.
How many days in a row do you spend in one place?
Until people get sick of me or the wines get bad. I don't know, either, whichever comes first. No, I celebrate daily my life with good wine and good people. And a lot of what I do is, it's not about, I think anyone can make great wine. I think what we have to do, though, is make wine from a place, and not just the vineyard. I'm talking about the people, the culture, and what all that brings to wine. Because we could go down to Argentina and we could make a Napa Valley Cabernet quite easily. But we
have
to.
Some people are trying to do that, aren't they?
And some people are trying to do that. And one of the other things I always employ, too, is I always encourage the clients that if they're going to hire a consultant, they need to hire a consultant from the country where they want to sell the wine, not from perhaps a consultant from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So tell us about Argento.
So Argento is a winery based in Mendoza. For those who haven't been down to Mendoza, it's the third largest city in Argentina.
It's a beautiful city.
It's a beautiful city, but it's certainly grown up since I've been going there. When I first started going there, it was 400,000 people. Now there's about 1.6 million.
Wow.
And the Mendoza city is actually in one of the appellations. So there's four main appellations in Mendoza, and Mendoza city is in the Central Valley, which is probably the preeminent region for Mendoza. Mm-hmm. So the other three appellations are San Rafael, which is in the south, the eastern region, which is more towards the north, Central Valley, as I said, and then the Ucor Valley, which is a relatively new appellation. Mm-hmm. These wines that we're going to try with you from Argento come from three of those appellations. So the white wines typically come from the eastern region. It's a little bit warmer down there, but we do have to put up with some sustained winds, and we also get a little bit more hail down there. Mm. So granny sow is a very common problem in Argentina and happens annually.
What is?
Hail.
But what did you call it?
Granny sow. It's the Spanish for hail. It's what everyone calls it down there.
And say the word again.
Granny sow.
Granny sow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the hail typically comes down from the Andes over the central region and out through the eastern region. So it's something that we have to deal with every year. And we actually put up hail netting now. It's very common.
So it's actually a real problem.
Oh, it's a huge problem. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So what are we going to try first?
So the first one that I've just poured is a Pinot Gris, we call it a Pinot Grigio. It's from, as I said, the eastern region where we have a little bit more wind. What you'll find with this wine, it tends to be a little bit more mineral and spicy because we also have fairly high salt soils. If you fly into Mendoza, as you have, you'll see that it's very, very brown. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a lot of water on the surface. Most of the water comes from underground. And what's happened is through time, the water tables have gradually risen, and so you have higher and higher salt content. And there are a number of regions in the world. Obviously, the big problem one that we have right now is Langhorne Creek in Australia. That region in particular, through over-irrigation, has become a fairly salty place to grow grapes. But what you find in the wines, though, is you find a lot more mineral and a lot more spice, and I think you'll see that when you try the Grigio.
Okay, so this is it. And it is
2010. Yep. We're getting ready for 2011.
That's right. It's almost time for your approaching harvest, right?
In fact, I'll be in Argentina in 3 more weeks. So I'll spend the whole of April, most of May, and a little bit of March in the region. So I try to knock out 5 countries in those 2 months. So I'll be in Chile, Argentina, New Zealand, Australia, and I'm hoping not to have to go to South Africa this time, but
to go where?
See, South Africa.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So this is.
So this wine's going to be a little bit more citrusy, some grapefruit characters, but pretty lively in the mouth.
There's a nice white grapefruit in there,
yeah,
which I like.
Yeah. And I try not to do it with acid. So what you'll find is it's got a little bit of CO2 in it, which just gives it that little bright spark on, mm-hmm, on the back of the mouth.
Yeah, just a little tiny bit. Yeah.
Everything in my life is a story, and I always...
Mouthful's all about stories, so do tell.
I first went to Portugal, making wine in Portugal in 93, and...
No, where in Portugal?
In the Douro.
Douro.
I didn't know anywhere else at the time.
Okay, yeah, I've been there. That's the one place in Portugal I've spent time.
Yeah. But when you hang out with winemakers there, you drink... You know, in those days, they didn't have anything else. We were over there making still wine under Tariga Nacional, but... So I'm there for 3 days... 3 days into it, you have ports, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, because
yes,
that's all they drink, man. They drive
you
crazy.
That was really almost all we drank. Every now and then, it was possible to get a beer.
Yeah. And you know how they're all skinny over in Portugal? It's because the food is so hard to eat. Have you noticed that? I mean, they eat a lot of these barnacles and shellfish and everything. You need about an hour to extract, you know, one mouthful out of all these barnacles and things they eat. So on the third day, I said, look, I hate to ask you, but can I get a white wine? You know, it's 110 out. I'm eating these barnacles, which are really hard to eat, and I wanted to have something else that was non-port.
Yeah.
So they brought me this glass. It was filled up to the rim. The condensation's pouring off it, and I just chug the thing. You know, I got, you know, the enamel on my teeth's gone, the roof of my mouth's all gone. But, you know, it's that sensation of, does that wine make you hungry or thirsty? And that's the sensation that we try to get in our wines. And we can do that by putting a little bit of residual CO2 in there, a little bit of residual carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
Well, the human threshold, it's naturally occurring, of course, during mm-hmm. fermentation, so mm-hmm. we can leave that in there.
So you can just capture it.
We can capture it. The human threshold's at about 1,200 milligram per liter, which is not as high, you know, champagne is obviously higher than that. But in this wine, we'll leave about 900 to 1,000 milligrams, so it's just below your threshold, so you mm-hmm. can't quite see it. But it just gives you a little brightness and that mm-hmm. little mouth-watering...
Tickle. A little high tickle.
That's it. Absolutely. And hopefully, it makes you want to go back and have that second glass, you know?
Yeah, it's quite nice. And there is that spicy. Tell me about the spice.
Well, when you grow vineyards in slightly windy regions, it really affects the amount of ripening. It's a very complicated thing to understand, even for me. But basically, when you have high wind and you have relatively high heat, supplemented with dry, with not much humidity, the stomata or the stomata of the leaves shut down. But with Pinot Grigio, we're only just figuring this out now, but Pinot Grigio, the stomata on the leaf actually shuts later than it does on, say, Cabernet or Merlot. Mm-hmm. Another varietal that shuts late is Syrah, and that's why when you walk into a Syrah vineyard around here especially, you can see the leaves starting to turn away because they're not, they become very flaccid and they're trying to preserve their own moisture, but they can't really do that with the stomata being open. So in a situation where you have that stomata remaining open, like you do with Pinot Gris, you get more of this spicy, I don't want to say green character, but you get a little bit of that greeny spice, just which is a residual of the varietal. Mm-hmm.
It's almost got almost a coriander.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, almost coriander or cilantro root, not cilantro leaf, but cilantro. If you do much Thai cooking, sometimes cilantro roots are called for, and you have to peel those little roots and then pound them. And I can see some of that.
Well, unfortunately, in Argentina, we don't get a lot of that. It's mainly beef, man. Whereas in Chile, it's nothing but sushi. And for those who love sushi, which I do, best sushi in the world is in Chile.
Really?
Yeah. And drinking a wine like this in Chile, eating sushi, man, it rocks.
Now, I never had sushi in Chile.
You're missing out.
I didn't have a lot of options. It was one of those press trips where nearly every minute was planned.
Yeah, I know what they're like. I try to stay away from those.
I would not have been to South America yet if I hadn't gone.
What should
we try? It's a well, name that I don't recognize, which is really great.
Yeah, Torrontés, or many other euphemisms of the name.
Okay, let's get
it. Since we have a screw cap, we don't have the cork sound.
Yes, no popping sounds.
Yeah.
So is that pretty common now in Argentina?
It's pretty common in the whole world.
Yeah.
It's only us curmudgeons in the U.S. that make us a little slow, but I think the U.S. consumer is gradually coming around, especially with, we have a new type of, one of the issues that we've got with the current screw cap is they're an energy hog. So they do, it is a lot of energy to make one, but we have new screw caps coming out now which are plastic and they are recyclable. But the opposite obviously is a cork, and people often say, well, cork is a natural product. But I have many friends in the cork industry, hoping they're not listening, but my argument is, well, when did you last see a white tree? Because corks are white, and so they're heavily bleached. And so where does all that peroxide or hydrogen peroxide go, which we bleach?
So they bleach the corks?
Absolutely.
I should have asked that question a long time ago, but I just sort of made this assumption that that's what happened when the corks dried.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem with cork is obviously mold. Now, they've taken huge, there's a huge increase in quality of cork these days.
Mm-hmm.
Versus even what we were doing 5 years ago.
There has to be if they want to compete.
That's true. But I'm not convinced that we've actually found the correct closure. Mm-hmm. I think screw cap is a good way to go. You know what? I'm working with some wineries using Zork corks now, which I think are fun and hip and cool. And
are you using what?
Zork, which are the glass seal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So they're quite
cool. Those are fine with
me.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been trying, last week we talked about Atlantic Seaboard wines.
Uh-huh.
We had, I think we tasted our way through half a dozen.
Wow.
And a number of them had plastic corks.
Yep.
I don't care for plastic corks.
Plastic corks are not bad. The only issue that seems to have been, there's from a physical standpoint or from a consumer standpoint, they're a little harder to pull out.
They are harder to pull out.
And from a wine quality standpoint, what they don't have is they don't have the memory. So when you take a cork, a natural cork, and you squeeze it, it pushes back out against the glass. When you take a synthetic cork and you squeeze it, that memory doesn't act as fast. So you've got to leave the bottle in a vertical position for a longer time because you don't want to have that random oxidation.
Right.
And you get that random oxidation by the cork not completely sealing against the glass. So that's the only issue with the synthetic.
Yeah.
You know what? I don't care. As long as the wine gets to the consumer in the soundest manner possible that was created by the vineyard and the winery.
I agree with you, except I want it to be easy to get to.
Well, you know? Screw caps are the answer.
Screw cap, for a while, you know, I was not an advocate of screw caps initially. And I still remember the first one. It was one, because I do that one of the week column.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the one, but it was very early in doing that. I swear I wish somebody would have been there with a video camera. I did everything except use, you know, a jackhammer to get that, right, to get the screw cap off. I felt stupid. It's like, this is a screw cap and I can't get it off. I could not get it off. And I finally took a wrench. And years later, I talked to somebody and said, you know, some of those early screw caps really were difficult, yeah, to get off. Because at that point, it was like, this is not an improvement. But lately, tell you a little secret about a lot of people in the food and wine world, at least locally. I won't name names, but a whole lot of us are drinking a Sauvignon Blanc from Chile. Vieux Menant.
Mm-hmm.
You must know it.
Mm-hmm.
It's $5.99 a bottle unless you buy it by a case, and you get a 10% discount by the case. I buy it at Traverso's. It's a great everyday wine.
It's not Sauvignon Blanc.
Hmm? It's not
Sauvignon Blanc. What is it? Sauvignon Ass and Sauvignon Americana, Sauvignon Vert. They call it, it's like in Chile, it's like when we drank, when we told everyone it was Merlot. Obviously, most of it was Carmenere. Now Carmenere has become a legal varietal. But most of what Sauvignon Blanc plantings have occurred in Chile are not Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh,
we're only just starting to plant Sauvignon Blanc now.
Quite, well, it's a nice, dry, white wine.
That's the point. See, that's the point.
Exactly.
It's not about what's on the label, no, or what the perception is. It's all about the find that you made, the quality that you saw in your mouth, how you drank it, how you consumed it, and who you drank it with. That's what's important about wine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this one, I was very surprised by it.
Yeah.
I think probably Michael Traverso said, no, you have to try this. I tried it. I was like, wow, this is really great.
Yeah.
And you can't beat the price.
No, it's a great wine.
Really refreshing.
Yeah.
And that screw cap just comes right off.
Yeah.
So that was nice. So now we're the Torrontés.
Torrontés. It's a very floral, very aromatic varietal. I like to describe it as a... sort of smells like muscat and tastes like Viognier. But if you know Viognier, Viognier has an astringency to it. Torrontés does not have that.
No. No astringency at all. The mid palate's really... It's soft, but it's lean.
Yeah.
You know, so many mid palate wines that have that buttery softness, or that are soft, have that buttery fatness.
Yeah.
This doesn't have that.
Yeah. Well, it's a crazy grape varietal. So we grow this in the far, far north. So this is up in Salta. So I've only been to Salta once, and I remember it not being very easy to get around. But these days, I understand, you know, they've even got a hotel there now, and there's large vineyard plantings up there. But again, it's not in the Mendoza or San Juan. San Juan is the county just to the north. So they're the main two grape-growing regions in Argentina. And then the third region is Salta, which is another aeroplane flight north. Because Argentina is a very, very long country.
Yes. It's, I was actually looking at a map just a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
It's really
I love this wine, and I love the region, and putting this, and for those people that like, you know, a little bit more tropical fruit characters in their wines, if they drink, you know, if they like drinking a Moscato or even sort of Treminas or Riesling, some of those Germanic varietals, it just has a little bit more to it in the nose, and yet it's not sickly sweet like I find
it's,
a lot of those
it's
wines.
Not cloying. Some of those wines can be really cloying. This one isn't. It's got those qualities, you say, but it's almost like those qualities are in the next room talking to you.
Yeah.
So I think it's refreshing. And some of those wines I don't necessarily find refreshing. And now we have pictures.
No, I'm just pulling out a map of Mendoza,
a map,
so you can see that.
Okay,
so
cool.
So the four main regions.
Now, when I was there, and if I'd done my homework properly, I would tell you exactly where, but it's a long story. I couldn't get to my notes. But one of the wineries we visited when we were in the Mendoza area was doing, in small lots, they had like, I don't know, 12 or 13 very, I didn't recognize a single grape varietal. And they were doing test fermentations of all these really unusual varietals. I found that fascinating.
You were at Catena?
I was at Catena, but
yeah,
this was
there.
Not Catena. I don't think this was Catena.
Because I know Catena, we've been, obviously I work with Catena. and we've been looking at all the various masal selections or field selections for Malbec. So we try to keep all these different field selections or different what we call clones over here separate just to evaluate each one. And there's well over 150 masal selections of Malbec in Argentina.
Yeah, this was not Catana. I love Catana. That was a real highlight of the trip.
Sure.
And I'm not a huge fan of Chardonnay. And
what? That's the varietal that keeps us rocking, baby.
You know, it's a workhorse, and there's enough people drinking it. I don't have to.
That's true.
That said, the Catena Chardonnay that we had down there was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
It was so good.
And
I've had Laura on the show.
All right. Yeah, she's a good friend of mine.
Yeah. She is great.
Well, the Chardonnay
and so
that
is
we
her father.
Grow. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, Nicholas and I have a long history. In one of the first places that we planted Chardonnay, when I worked for Chandon, we're making champagne down there, obviously. It's one of the best areas in the world for champagne. But the Chardonnay and Pinot we're growing up in
Tupungato. You mean the Mendoza area is?
Yeah, is in Tupungato. Tupungato is a sub-region of the Ulco, and that's where we grew most of the Pinot and Chardonnay. That's what took us up there. And La Consulta, which is a new area, relatively new area that people have started talking about, is a sub-region also of the Ulco, but it's a little bit further to the south. And then Miraflores, Vista Flores, and Tunajan are probably the more of the traditional areas up there, which I find fascinating. And one of the wines we'll try with you, the Malbec, comes from that area.
Well, I like this white wine. I like both of these. They're quite lovely.
Well, the next wine I'm going to show you is also unusual. And I'm going to open the screw cap here close to the microphone, see if it makes a snap. All right, did you hear that? Man, that was refreshing. So this grape varietal is very interesting as well. This is Bonarda, and I could talk all day about the comings and goings of Argentina, but Argentina's in a very interesting position right now with the Chilean earthquake, which I happen to have missed the big one, but I was there for the number two. So I was there for the 7.1. I wasn't there for the 7.7. And I also missed the New Zealand one by 5 hours. I was in New Zealand,
really?
Too. My wife was there, but I missed it, luckily. But anyway, one of the fallouts of that was the big glass plant in Chile fell over. And so much of the glass that's used for the wine industry in Argentina is manufactured in Chile. So cost of dry goods have gone up substantially in Argentina as a result. The second thing is inflation. And obviously, we're in the currency game because we're making wine all around the world and trying to work out, you know, what's going to be next. But inflation down there is running at 26%. The harvest in Argentina this year is 10%. It's going to be 10% off. And
why? For what
reason?
Well,
we had frost.
Okay.
We had a frost. I was there, actually, in November. We had a frost. And we, in Esmeralda, or Ucatechi, which is another appellation, we lost, of the 2 foot of canopy, we lost about a foot of canopy, which is a very severe frost, and late in the season as well. So those things are going on in Argentina, and also subsequent to that is they've changed the rules. I know this sounds really funny, but they've changed the rules in Argentina in that you have to be, the paperwork really, really has to match. The wine going into the winery has to equal the wine coming out. So what we found is Bonarda is a very interesting grape varietal for blending with Malbec and Cabernet, and you'll find that if you, and I'm not being, I don't want to overstate this, and I'm not saying that everyone does it, but if the wine is sort of $12 or $15 and under, you'll probably find that it was historically had a fair amount of Bonarda in it. Mm-hmm. And if you try Bonarda is a fantastic grape varietal. It's very sweet and round and lush, but it's an unknown grape varietal, so it's very hard for people to gravitate to it. But we're doing one under the Argento label. We grow it in the eastern region, which is where we also grow the Pinot Grigio. And you'll find it's just sort of very berry and cherry, and we try to keep it simple and in that vein.
Where did it originate?
It's an Italian grape varietal, and to be honest, I've forgotten the name, but somebody asked me yesterday about it. But you get a little, a little coffee and spice, a bit of soy, and sort of, it gives me a little bit of Zinfandel. It's not Zinfandel-y, but it sort of has that Zinfandel vein. I get a little bit of that walnut character, black cherry. So a little deeper in character than what you'd find with a Malbec or a Cabernet.
Initially, the first sensation on the palate is a really pretty silkiness.
Exactly.
Just really silky instantly.
Yeah.
And then you get a little bit of, not fuzziness from the tannins, but you then sense the tannin. You know it's not a Pinot Noir after a couple seconds, well, but it does have that really appealing silkiness right at first.
Well, one of the tricks is to play around again with the acid. We sort of leave the acid alone because the acid is in fairly good balance with the pH. And when you say silky, to me, that's all about pH. And so as a winemaker geek, you know, pH is a 3.8 and under is safety. In fact, under 3.7 is safer, you know, for Brettanomyces and things for that. Mm-hmm. But what I like to do is because of the way I've made wines and at Simi and Clos de Bois and all these places is trying to push the pH at least to 3.8 to try and get that sweet sensation without having to drive that wine with a lot of alcohol to try and shoot off the sweetness to cover up the tannins.
Yeah. What sort of alcohols are you?
These are all under 14. They're all under 14.
Under
Bonato,
14, good.
Yeah. So we don't need to get the sweetness through alcohol, as I said. We can just get it through the mouthfeel.
There were a lot of wines hovering around 15 or so when I was down on the trip I went on. And I was one of the lonely voices saying, do you ever make wines lower in alcohol?
I find all of that fascinating. I find alcohol fascinating, malolactic, wood, you know, all these words that consumers use and gaining an understanding of what those words mean. Mm-hmm. But I do these tastings so all the time, and I do it with sommeliers as well, where I will give them four wines and ask them to pick which one has the highest alcohol or which one they prefer, and they'll always gravitate to the one with the highest alcohol.
They will.
And if you say, oh, I don't like malolactic, then you give them a bunch of wines, and guess what they drink? They drink the one with all the malolactic.
Really?
I don't like wood, and they always end up drinking. You know, so it's not about... It's like a great chef. You don't want the guy out in the who's sitting at the dining table going, "Hey, can you make me a steak? And can you do it this way and
this
do that way?"
Right.
So
yeah,
you know, the chef is it's his opportunity to show off what he can do best. And I think from a winemaking standpoint, we should try and make wines that represent the vineyard, that represent the culture, and represent our personality, because personality is such an important part and culture is such an important part in terms of putting wines together.
We're going to take a little musical break now, and we'll be back on Mouthful with more talk with Nick Goldschmidt.
Thank you.
Of course, a little tango music while we are talking about Argentine wines. Okay, the Bonarda, the lovely Bonarda, into the dump bucket. And now we have...
And you can try Bonarda. All of these wines are sort of under $15. So they're great buys. And for those who don't know a little bit about the company, it's actually owned by an English chap. Well, four people. They own a... doesn't mean much to anyone, but they own a company called Bibendum. Bibendum are the largest distributor in the world. And they own this brand, or they created this brand with Nicolas Catena. And this is probably the largest Argentinian brand in the world, and it's not sold in the US. It's only just been released in the US in the last 6 months. So it's a fantastic brand. It's got a great track record. And the ability to produce exceptionally good value is really untapped, especially with a brand like this.
The value is really, I mean, I don't understand enough of the economics. I don't know why they can sell wines at the price they sell in the United States.
Right. Well, when the peso is fixed 4-1, works well. That's only when the inflation's not at 26%, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
But as long as Obama keeps printing money, I think we'll be fine.
Okay.
Anyway, so we've just poured you the Malbec. This is the 2009. 2009 was, of all the vintages that have been down in Argentina, I've had two 10 out of 10 vintages, and 2009 was one of them. And everything just sort of hit at once. It was just... You know, it wasn't too hot, wasn't too windy, we didn't have a lot of hail, and everything just came to fruition at just the right time. We had good space between white grapes and red grapes. And then 2010, which we had the white wines from, I would classify as an 8.5 to 9 out of 10. It was not a bad vintage at all. 2011, it's going to be a little bit more difficult.
Shaky.
We'll see.
Well, drinking this Malbec makes me want a steak. A steak and maybe a few empanadas.
Your Malbec, I don't know. It's, again, when I drink this wine, it immediately takes me back to the place. Mm-hmm. And I know where I am, what I'm doing, and you're right. Eating asado, out in the sun by the swimming pool, which is exactly what all my mates are doing down in Argentina today, right now. They were texting me photos of the... Well, we don't call it beef down there. It's we eat all sorts of things other than beef. Intestines, cheeks, black sausage, and everything else.
Oh, yeah, you eat the innards, which are fabulous.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
And we live in a little town called Chacras, which is about 20 minutes from downtown Mendoza, and myself and a business partner, we have a house there. And Argento also has a house there in the same block. And, yeah, the parties, I mean, every night. It's just such a social country.
And, yeah, it seemed like people weren't so isolated. They hung out. They ate a lot.
And
it
in Chacras, Chacras is where all the winemakers live. Mm-hmm. All the winemakers from all around the region live there. And within three blocks, if you're on the main square of Chacras, it reminds me a lot of Healdsburg, where I live now. It's just restaurant, bar, butcher. So it's a really cool place to hang out, you know.
Well, speaking of living in Healdsburg, let's just depart from Argento just a little bit and talk about your label, your wine.
Well, the first wine that I made was a brand called Forefathers, and Forefathers was created in 1998. I'm on an aeroplane down to Cloudy Bay because Cloudy Bay was part of Louis Vuitton, and I'm thinking to myself, why am I going all the way to Cloudy Bay to make Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, Cabernet, Merlot, Syrah, everything from the same vineyard, when we know that it is impossible to have one vineyard make the best of every varietal. So Forefathers came about by being the forefather appellation for that variety in the New World. So when we talk about Forefathers, when you think about Sauvignon Blanc, you think New Zealand. When you think Shiraz, you think Australia. When you think Cabernet, for me, it's California. And when you think Malbec, it's Argentina.
What do you think when you, with Pinot Noir?
I don't make a Pinot Noir under the Forefathers label.
Cause okay.
Because Pinot to me has so many different... I
was just curious.
Well, I make Pinot under another label called Boulder Bank. Boulder Bank is a pure New Zealand brand. And if you try that Boulder Bank Pinot, I make it with very little wood. I try to make it very sweet, very very fruit-driven, low alcohol, and I really want to show the vibrancy of that fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And Boulder Bank is one of my biggest brands now. And that we make a Pinot Noir and a Sauvignon Blanc under that. And then my big label is obviously Goldschmidt, which is my top wine out of Oakville, and then I have a vineyard in the Alexander Valley. And then I make a wine with my three daughters. So I have five kids, and I have Chelsea and I make a Merlot together. Catherine and I make a Cabernet together. And then Hillary is a little young, but we make a Napa Cab under with her. But, yeah, no, it's...
So the other two boys, there must be...
Well, I shouldn't say this, but there's three things that don't sell in my world. Boys' names, dogs, and blue labels. And I've been, you know, after working for corporations all my life, the number of blue labels I've seen in my life or the number of boys' names I've seen in my life, another introductory closeout, we'd like to say.
Really?
Anyway, that's my little theory.
Interesting, okay.
That's my little theory. Anyway, I enjoy working with my daughters. It's a lot of fun.
Okay. You have my head spinning. You make so many wines that it's...
Yeah, wines...
It's remarkable.
And I also work in high tech, and I'm a liquid trader. So,
wait, you work in high tech?
High tech. We're working on some equipment now beyond biodynamics and organics. We're working on a machine called a VSIP, which is a... I give this company a free plug. It's a company in Emeryville called New Logics. And New Logics has created this machine called a VSIP. It's a vertical shear filter. And we can basically take water out of anything. So we can put it's a series of discs that we stack. We put a resin on the outside of those discs and we can charge them any way we want. So you know how chlorine is Cl minus. So we charge the resin with a negative. A negative repels negative. And that machine shakes. We can take the chlorine straight out of the water. Or we can take water out of oil. We can take water out of anything you want. I'm also working on a biodigester called Live. Spelt L-Y-V-E. We've put three of them in already in Napa. Working on a company...
What is that?
Live. It's a biodigester.
Okay.
It's an aerobic biodigester. Most of them are anaerobic. This one's aerobic.
What's its purpose?
Well, we can clean up
water
with yeast and bacteria or winery byproduct with very little impact on the septic system.
Okay.
So we put one in at Rombauer, which has been very successful. Uh-huh. That was the first one. And we're putting one in at Camus at the moment.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm working on this will scare people a little bit. It's a DNA shredder out of South Africa. We call it SurePure. Basically, it upsets the DNA of the yeast and the bacteria so we don't have to filter. It's a very good way, and then we don't have to add so much preservatives. It's just a new technique that's being explored right now. And then a sonication machine out of Australia called Cavitas.
Sonication?
Sonication means that if you get in the swimming pool, I don't know whether we should be talking about this on air. You get in the swimming pool and we put a probe in there, we can send a sonic pulse through the water and we can kill you by all the gas that's inside your body will blow up. And that's what we can do inside yeast and bacteria as well. So these are...
We don't want that to get into the wrong hands.
Well, no, this is exactly the way... You know, it's when I say it's beyond biodynamics and organics, I mean that these are techniques that are very, very simple, great ways for our new sensitive environment for food consumption.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to pasteurize at 180 Fahrenheit anymore. We can pasteurize at 80 Fahrenheit and use one of these techniques.
Really?
And there are a couple
so
of
we're
very,
about
very,
to see a
we are
revolution?
Working with some very, very large companies right now who are in the liquid food business who currently pasteurize, and through some of these technologies they will not need to do that anymore, which means the consumer is going to have a safer product with less preservatives and more flavor.
So how will that impact, do we know yet, how will that impact the cheese industry?
We're not working with anyone in the cheese industry yet,
uh-huh.
But
I mean, that's such a big issue
yeah.
in the cheese industry, yeah. pasteurized versus non-pasteurized.
Right. But
it's huge.
We can obviously do it with milk.
Uh-huh.
And so obviously a byproduct from that will be cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we are working down that track. Anyway, getting off the subject of wine, but so, you know, I do work with some really cool, interesting weirdos in the wine industry.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky that at my age I can be a little bit selective about who I get to work with. And I basically work with people who are fun and committed and dedicated and cool.
And like what they do and have a good and have a good time doing it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Malbec. How did Malbec first come to Argentina?
Well, I sound like I'm Argentinian now. I go back to another story. I made wine in Mexico for quite some time. In Mexico,
where?
In the Guadalupe, of course. There's 12 wineries. Of the 13 wineries, there's 13 wineries in Mexico, 12 of them in Guadalupe. But in Mexico, they were conquered by every grape producing country. The French came, the Italians came, the Germans came, and the Spaniards came. They got every varietal known to man in the Guadalupe Valley. In Argentina, it was a little bit different. It was basically dominated by French, which is very unusual for me because when you're in Argentina, they still look to the mothership as being Spain. And same thing in Chile. And yet here we are dominated by Bordeaux grape varietals. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also part of the evolution of training consumers. And so the consumers looked to France and thought that those wines were the best things that you could buy because they were expensive and they were around. I mean, they'd been marketed well, mm-hmm. unlike Spanish wines. And so people gravitated to that style of wine. And I think we see that right now in the explosion of China as a consuming nation. Who's going to get in there first and educate the consumer that this is how wine tastes? And we're not desperate enough in the US right now to go to China and educate the Chinese to drink American wine. What the French are doing is they're more desperate because they've fallen on harder times, mm-hmm. and so they're dominating the Chinese industry right now with a lot of cheap French wine, and they're training the Chinese palate, subconsciously to be drinking mm-hmm. French wine.
Yeah, they're creating that expectation.
So going back to Malbec, I think Malbec is such a user-friendly consumer wine. It's like what we talked about with the Bonarda. It has a little higher pH, has a little sweeter fruit, and yet it's a wine that we can manipulate in a way, because it has a little bit more tannin than Bonarda, we can manipulate it in a way to make it a little bit more powerful and rich and intense than, say, what Bonarda was. Mm-hmm. And so Malbec can wear many clothes, but for us, we're dedicated at Argento to growing Malbec at a higher elevation where it's a bit cooler, and so you can have a little bit more dark fruit than sort of the red fruit. Mm-hmm. So you won't get the raspberry blueberry, but you'll get the black cherry and sort of blackberry mm-hmm. character.
Black raspberry, yeah. It seems.
Such an easy one to drink, and I can drink gallons.
And I bet you do.
Well, I try.
Okay.
I'm at least surrounded by people who try as well. And then the last wine that we have here is... We have this is the 2009 Cabernet, and Cabernet to me is the really interesting varietal down in Argentina. It's, we can make great Cabernets throughout the world. We can make them in Australia. We can't make them in New Zealand.
You can't.
Despite what the New Zealanders still tell you.
Why?
I don't think we can get Cabernet ripe in New Zealand.
Yeah.
We can get Merlot ripe, but not Cab.
What about in Canada? Going to get...
Anyway, in Chile...
okay. You'll have
to talk about
Canada.
Yeah, I'm not convinced about... Well, I'm working... I was just saying, that's what we're laughing about, Canada. I've just come from the Okanagan, and I'm in love with the Okanagan, but that's another radio show.
Okay. Will you come back and talk about it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool.
But, some of the best Cabernets in the world, I hate to tell you, come from Chile. And... There's so much character in Argentina because you're talking about mainly west-facing slopes, so they're warmer. Whereas in Argentina, you're talking about east-facing slopes because obviously the Andes are in the middle, and so everyone plants on the east-facing or the morning sun. And morning sun is very important because it's a great way not to get dehydration in the grapes, and we get a lot more ripening and a lot more hang time relative to, a west-facing slope. So in Cabernet... It's almost like a cool climate Cab. They're grown at high elevations. In fact, one of these vineyards in the Reserva line that we haven't tried yet, I've actually skied the vineyard in the winter. That's how high up these things are.
Wow.
And so with this wine, you're going to get a lot of depth of fruit without a lot of winemaking process complexity. So we don't have to cover this wine up with wood. We don't have to bury it with added tannin. We don't have to cover it up with sugar. These Cabernet from Argento and Cabernet from Argentina is such a great natural product that I can only see great things happening to this mm-hmm. varietal going forward.
It's a very pretty Cab.
Not bad. Yeah. Got lucky.
Yeah, it's very pretty. It's not... inky.
Right.
It's not that real dark and inky. It's not like a baseball bat to the head.
Yeah, we can certainly do that. I mean, we can pair it up with alcohol and wood and everything, but...
But why?
correct, because when you think about the food that you're eating in Argentina, you want it to marry happily with fresh mm-hmm. beef. And we do eat a lot of salads down there too, so it's okay. But you know, it's all about liveliness and fruitiness mm-hmm. and waking the palate up. And if you bury it with high alcohol and wood, you're just not going to get that same sensation.
You don't enjoy things. It doesn't flatter the food. And in my circles, you can't drink as much. So if you're on the winemaking side of things, don't you want to make something that people will drink a lot of? Because then they'll buy more?
Well, Michelle, you know, that's true. My definition of success is when you go into a restaurant and you're standing at the bar before you go and sit down for your meal, and you ask the barman, I'll have a glass of Cabernet or a glass of Malbec, and you drink that glass and you say, same again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because if you say, well, that was cool, what else you got? That doesn't work for me. So I want to be able to have two glasses and drink them easily
mm-hmm.
without too much brain matter being involved.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds good. Well, this is lovely. Now, you said that these wines have been introduced in the United States for just like the last 6 months.
Correct.
So and where can people get them locally?
You know what? That's a really good question. They didn't come armed with that information.
Okay,
but I can certainly get that information for you.
And what I will do is when we get that information, I will post it on Mouthful's Facebook page.
You're awesome.
So there it is. And also, people should know that they can always send me email, catsmilk@sonic.net. It's catsmilk@sonic.net, and I will answer any questions about things. But yeah, just give me that information. I'll get it right up on Mouthful's Facebook page.
Cool.
Okay, now.
Well, we have a couple of reserve wines. No, we don't. We only have one. That's great. So we've just got the Malbec Reserva. So this is grown down in the central region. And the central region is the region that I got to know the best in my early years in Argentina. So the central region is made up of famous areas like Vistalba. Vistalba is probably the most well-known area. Vistalba, Pedrial is another area. Agrallo, La Lunta, Luján, and Ugatechi. These are all areas that are in the central region, and these are the traditional areas. And if you think about how vineyards are planted or where people go, it's all about the roads and the ability to get there. And even back in the 80s when I was first started going down there, it was very hard to get around. Mm-hmm. Remember, in Chile, we were still living with Pinochet, and in Argentina, the junta had gone from power. But there was a lot of residual still left over. And so a lot of the country had not been developed. So it was very easy to grow vineyards close to town. Just so happened to turn out that it was also one of the best areas in the world to grow grapes as well. Subsequent to that, of course, we've discovered the other areas in the Uco. And so that area has come on. But still to this day, I find that the central region is the best region for mm-hmm. growing some of the finest wines. These vineyards are well over 150 years old. They are planted very closely together. And I find it's interesting. I'm actually speaking at the Global Warming Conference in Oregon week after next. And they've asked me to speak on how canopy management has changed through time or through this global uncertainty in terms of weather.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that what we're doing is we're heading back to a culture that was before we had irrigation and before we had mass transport. We're now taking vineyards back to that same era. So it's sort of come a full circle, and I find the whole thing very fascinating.
Now, what is it about going back to that era that is compatible with the climate change we're going through?
That's going to be very... Well, I think...
Was that a fair question?
It's a very fair question, but it's a very hard question to answer quickly. I think what's going to make us... It's going to make us make wines that are true to type.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to be less competitive with the environment and more working with the environment.
Okay.
So we're moving into a culture where water is going to be the scarcest resource
yes.
that we've ever had and we've ever faced. And so we're going to have to farm economically and sensibly and sustainably. And through that, I think that we're going to go to vineyards that have closer planting vines and less crop, because we're not going to be able to power them up with mm-hmm. all this water to produce big canopies and therefore produce large crops. And I, I think for the, from a consumer standpoint, it's going to be very interesting. And from a winemaking standpoint, it's going to sort the men out from the boys.
Hmm.
And I think we will have more truth. And when you try this wine, this Reserve Malbec, off these vineyards that are 150 years old, and this wine is still priced at under $20, how can we do that in Napa Valley or Alexander Valley and make a and make a competitive argument to why people should drink our wines when we can get these wines? Even though I make wine in Napa and Alexander Valley.
Yeah, I know. I think it's a really good point. You know, I that's another whole discussion as well. But what is it that makes you choose? I mean, is it a commitment to local, so you buy a more expensive wine once you know about these others?
Michelle, I still think it's about a story. And I'm, again, I'm actually, believe it or not, it's funny when times are tough, I get asked to speak everywhere. When times are good, no one ever asks me to speak anywhere at all. So I'm speaking at the Napa Valley Grape Growers Association in a couple of weeks and as well. And the subject there is, you know, what's the future, or how's Napa Valley going to hold its strength? And for me, the Napa Valley has been tarnished a little by the price of everything. And we've found, I don't want to name individual, we've found some wealthy individuals that have gone in there and hope to create a legacy for themselves and for the family. But unfortunately, the legacy is not what it's about. What it's about is who you are, why you did it, how you grow the grapes, and why you make the wine that particular way. And you can't just do it in five years. I mean, this is a 10-year, 20-year commitment minimum, and then hopefully a second or third generation. And that's part of the story. And I think long-term in the Napa Valley, we're going to see smaller and smaller vineyards, and we're going to see more vertical integration between the vineyard and going to bottle. And I think that's going to be, again, really interesting for the consumer and provide the consumer with more options as well. And that's exactly what's happened in Argentina too. In Argentina, in the central region, this is relatively expensive land because, as I said, Mendoza has grown by leaps and bounds in terms of population. So the land is relatively expensive. So what we've found is that these vineyards have become smaller and smaller. And so, you know, I don't know what the average size vineyard would be down there, but I see many vineyards at around about the 2 hectare, 3 hectare size, or, you know, 6 acres, five or 6 acres. Same thing in Spain. I work in the Rioja in Spain. Same thing there. The land is very expensive, but the grapes are relatively cheap. They don't have water either, but they make their money by selling the land in the third generation, and that's how they sort of maintain it. So I find, going back to Argentina, it's just a very interesting and in a very unique situation that we've got with these small growers and being able to go back to the place of where we can make great wines and garner up three or four of these little properties and make a wine such as you're trying right now.
And so this is the Reserve. And is it also 2009?
This is 2009, yeah.
2009.
We,
just,
we bottled this about December.
And so what does this sell for?
This is under $20.
Under, I thought that's what you said.
It should be about $18.
Like, so $18 for a Reserve Malbec.
Malbec, yeah.
So what? How would you describe the differences between the other one and the Reserve?
The classic level, well, firstly, we're talking about two different regions. So in the classic, we're talking about being up in the Uco, which is newer vineyards, a little bit more glacial soil, so a little bit more free draining than what you'll get down the central region. In the central valley, I know the central valley has a bad terminology here in California, but it's not
the same thing.
It's not the same thing. So the central valley down there has a little bit more clay, which means we have a bit more water holding capacity, which means we can push that vine to a higher level of ripeness.
And on that note, I looked at the clock and we are just about out of time.
Well, thank you for having me on, Michelle. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. It's Nick Goldschmidt. How you do so many things. Is there a website where people can go for information?
Absolutely. We, we're IP on our new website, but it's goldschmidtvineyards.com. G-O-L-D-S-C-H-M-I-D-T, vineyards, plural.com.
Okay, great. And I will also put that on the Facebook page.
You can get me on, and actually that's the quickest way for people to get a hold of me. If you can, you can join Goldschmidt Vineyards on my Facebook page.
Oh, great.
And I have all my other brands there too. You can get on Boulder Bank, And then I've got like 10 other brands that you can get on the vault, on the Facebook page too. But if you get me on Goldschmidt, that's the easiest way to track me.
Uh-huh.
And you'll see, I put up photos regularly of where I am and what I'm doing.
Oh, that's great. So we can track you that way. Outstanding.
Absolutely.
Well, Nick, thank you so much. I hope you, where are you going tomorrow?
New Jersey.
That's right. You're going to stay warm.
28 degrees.
Take good warm socks. Yeah. And next week we are continuing to talk about wine. We will have Joel Peterson here talking about all things Zinfandel. And some of the stories that Joel Peterson has are just so, they're so amazing, including the history of the name of the winery, Ravenswood. I'm going to make him, I think every time he's on, I make him tell that story. It's like one of your favorite bedtime stories. You can hear it over and over. So next week, it is Joel Peterson here on Mouthful. In the meantime, have a great week. Take care of yourself. Take care of others. And meet me back here for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour on KRCB-FM.
Mouthful is hosted and produced by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to catsmilk@sonic.net. That's catsmilk@sonic.net. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast at krcb.org or from iTunes.
And the moral of this story, children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough, even he'll get hungry too, and he'll sing.